Chapter 36. Perfect Storm. Growing ice thick enough for Hugh and Godric to walk on was easy enough. Growing ice thick enough and fast enough for them to run on it was rather more difficult. Growing ice thick enough and fast enough for them to run on it while also being bombarded with spells from the living siege tower was, frankly, insane. Hugh would run short on ways to describe escalating difficulty, if he was honest. The two of them only pulled it off, working together. They slid to a halt amidst the foundations of what looked like an Ithonian bank or something of the sort. Behind them, the ice bridge they'd crossed the canal on crumbled beneath the weight of a brand new tree, as well as what had looked like a lava bomb. Hugh had no idea how the Havathi were still managing to target them while Arta was tearing apart their tower. They'd expected this to be an easy way to work their way back towards the rest of their group, but the Havathi had been on them the whole time.
"That wasn't a lava bomb," Godric said.
"It sure looked like one,"
Hugh said, catching his breath. Not so much from the run. Alustin's training easily had him in the best shape of his life. More from the stress of trying to hold so many spell forms in his mind's eye at the same time.
"It was congealed volcanic ash from an andesitic volcano, I think."
Hugh gave him a blank look.
"Basically, there are two types of volcanoes," Godric said. "The kind that erupt liquid lava and the kind that explodes. Abyla was a liquid magma mage, and if we'd been fighting on basalt, she would have been even more dangerous. Andesite is a kind of stone that you find in exploding volcanoes."
"So more or less dangerous than Abyla?"
Hugh asked.
"Differently dangerous," Godric said.
"Lovely."
In the distance, there was another immense crash as Arta struck his hammer against the tower. This time, however, the tearing, ripping noises kept going.
"Hey, Hugh," Godric said. "The tower's probably going to make for a lot of rubble when it falls, right?"
"Yes,"
Hugh said.
"And a lot of it is going to fall in the water, right?"
Godric asked.
"I guess so," Hugh said.
"Probably making a rather large splash and some rather large waves,"
Godric said. Hugh looked hesitantly at Godric.
"I think we should maybe get out of the water and up into the city now,"
Godric said. In the distance, the tearing and crumbling noises grew even louder.
"I think you might be right," Hugh agreed.
Talia had to admit, her celebration when Arta started tearing apart the tower was rather diminished when it started falling towards them. She even paused firing dream wasps for a moment. It wasn't an abrupt, complete collapse. It was a slow, halting fall as the vines and trees tore and shattered. It would still crush her just as flat, however. Then, before she could react, she was flying up into the air, lifted up by one arm. She was already a good 20 feet into the air, moving rapidly sideways out from the direction of the tower's fall, when she thought to look back. It was, of course, Alustin carrying her, his armour having sprouted great buzzing dragonfly wings, fashioned out of paper.
"Cover us!"
Alustin shouted. Talia smirked, then turned back to face the tower, in case any Havathi mages were escaping. There were, unfortunately, quite a lot of them escaping, largely by air.
"Of course they have flyers!"
she yelled, as she started haphazardly blasting dream wasps their way.
"Why didn't they use them before?"
"It doesn't make much sense," Alustin agreed, as he landed them on a nearby roof. The wings and his armour looked like they were losing their integrity from flying in the light rain.
The tower impacted the city, crushing at least a dozen Ithonian buildings. Lake water and broken masonry were sent hurtling into the air. Arta's massive armoured form lumbered towards the fallen tower and the escaping Havathi.
"I still don't get how Arta's not a great power," Talia said.
"He's probably powerful enough to fit into their lower ranks. He's just never challenged another great power for recognition or territory, Alastin said. He doesn't want the stress, though. You've got to be a little bit insane to want to be a great power.
Alastin sounded distracted as he spoke, however, and Talia knew he was scrying.
I believe I figured out why the Havarthi didn't use their flyers until now, Alastin said.
Why's that? Talia asked.
Because they were trying to delay us, too. There's a small wing of Havarthi dragons on their way now, ferrying more mages this way, Alastin said. Also, there appears to be a strike force that hit outside the tower, and is currently cutting their ways through Hugh's wards, protecting the exile splinter.
Let's go then, Talia said.
Alastin shook his head.
I won't be able to fly there carrying you in this rain. I'll barely be able to make it myself. Can I trust you not to get yourself killed and try and reunite with the others?
Talia drew her enchanted daggers and smiled. Alastin made it to the Emperor's Plaza just as the full force of the storm hit. He barely landed next to the exile splinter in time to keep his wings from collapsing, and rapidly covered his paper armor in sheets of waxed paper to protect it from the rain. He didn't worry about being attacked directly. He'd landed in the middle of Hugh's wards. He hated having to do that. Wax paper was a hassle and a half to control. Of all the paper he kept in his tattoo, it was easily his least favorite to use.
Alastin Haber, a voice said.
Alastin idly looked up at the hand of Sacred Swordsman facing him. Unfortunately, he recognized them. The average swordsman only lasted a year or two in the line of duty. Any swordsman was dangerous, but the veterans were by far the worst. The younger ones were often, well, idiots. Warlocks weren't common enough that you could be overly choosy when constructing a force out of them, and most weren't temperamentally suited for membership in an elite force of battle mages, simply because most people in general weren't. Those that were temperamentally suited, however, were usually the ones that survived more than a few years. And unfortunately, every member of the Hand currently facing him was a veteran. Worse, he suspected all their weapons were fully sapient. Amberglow, the Marrow Staff, Olsti's Hyphal, the Spring Cloak, Forgeheart. The Havarthi warlocks had names of their own, of course, but Alastin only ever bothered referring to most swordsmen by the names of their weapons. Amberglow and Forgeheart were the only two actual swords among them, and the back of his head insisted that the swordsmen really needed to change their name to something that acknowledged their wide range of weapons.
Spring Cloak, Alastin acknowledged. This doesn't look particularly good for you, Alastin, Spring Cloak said. You know, one of you always says that to me. I think I might have some doubts in regards to the quality of Havarthi judgment about that, Alastin said.
Olsti's Hyphal had already broken through four of Hugh's primary wards around the splinter, leaving only two between Alastin and the swordsman. The living fungal armor wasn't the most effective direct combat tool, but it was terrifyingly effective for ward breaking and siegecraft. The armor could sprout a fibrous mycelial network of astonishing size in short order, perfect for tearing apart just about anything, given a little time. Unfortunately, magical fungal growths were also particularly effective against paper.
It's usually traditional for us to attempt to persuade our foes to join us or surrender peacefully, Forgeheart said. Even with all your crimes against Havarth, I still feel compelled to offer you the opportunity. It would be a genuine shame to kill one of the only two remaining Helicotan saber-wielders. A couple of the others gave Forgeheart irritable looks at his offer.
Alastin was widely hated by many swordsmen for the sheer number of their ranks he'd killed, and many hated the standing offer of amnesty the Havarthi Duox had on offer for him if he would join them.
You already know what my answer is, Alastin said, drawing his own sword from his tattoo.
And while there may be two of us who still wield the Lord of Bells' enchantments, only one of us still counts as Helikoten. Alustin could feel water dripping down the back of his neck, from where it was leaking through the wax paper somewhere. Even in normal conditions, you'd be hard-pressed to escape a hand of veterans, Forchart said. In a rainstorm where you need to defend a fixed position, you don't stand a chance. Please, Alustin, don't simply dismiss this offer. Valia holds out hope for you still, you know. There was a flash as the Hyphal's burrowing mycelium broke through another of Hugh's wards, leaving only one left. Very well, Alustin said. A moment, please. Amberglow snorted in disdain, while Marrowstaff laughed bitterly. Ulstes' Hyphal remained focused on her work. Springcloak shook his head. I'm sure this is just another of your tricks, but you have until we broke through the last ward to consider. Well, this was going to be a problem. Sabi Wind jumped off another balcony, just as one of the pursuing sacred swordsmen struck it with another spray of metal bits. They weren't molten, but they ignited into flame the instant they came into contact with water, which meant the instant the swordsman launched them, considering how hard it was raining. She'd already been hit by a couple of chunks already, and had the burns to show for them on her arm. Sabe landed on another balcony, and slid into the dark room connecting to it, to hide. Across the canal, the swordsman slowly glided down to the balcony she'd just vacated, drawing the flaming bits of metal back into her staff, which was apparently made of the stuff, considering that it was burning too. Gravity affinities, plus just about anything else, tended to be a nasty combination. The Hervathi spent a few moments looking for Sabe, but thankfully didn't spot her. Eventually, she took off again, and Sabe sighed a breath of relief. This was the first time she'd evaded Hervathi pursuit, since she'd killed the Vine Whip wielder. She took a moment to consider her options as she healed the burns on her arm. Part of her wanted just to huddle up here and rest, but her friends were out there fighting somewhere, and she couldn't abandon them. The only one whose location she knew at the moment was Arta's, but then it would be pretty difficult to lose track of Arta at the moment. Approaching Arta when he was in full battle armor was definitely a bad idea, though. She doubted he'd be able to easily tell her apart from any of the Hervathi flyers. Wind jumping wasn't too much different from a force mage's leaps. Only the most powerful force mages could truly fly, and she'd spotted several force mages leaping about among the Hervathi. No, making for the exile splinter made the most sense at the moment. The closer she got to it, the more of their pre-established defences she'd cross, putting her on a better and better footing. She'd have to take the long way around to do it, though. Arta and the collapsed living tower, as well as the majority of the Hervathi, lay between her and it. And going the long way would take, well, entirely too long. No, if she were going to do this, she needed to do it underwater. Godric and Hugh had just managed to climb up onto a balcony when three of the Hervathi attacked them from a neighbouring rooftop. All wore the pristine white uniforms of Havarth with their bronze decorations, but only two of them wore the insignia of the Sacred Swordsman. One of those seemed to be carrying an odd-looking pair of pliers and a shield filled with different-sized holes, along with coils of wire hung all around his body, while the other had what looked like several iron plates floating in the air around him. The regular battle mage only managed to hit Godric with a single firebolt before Hugh responded with a starbolt. Godric had been maintaining the anti-glare cantrip for just this purpose, but the starbolt still left after images. One part of Godric wanted to laugh hysterically about Hugh incinerating a fire mage. Another part wanted to vomit. A third noted that the Hervathi had just been a battle mage and not a swordsman. While a fourth part somehow kept it together and tossed you through the door leading inside from the balcony. Godric, the ice of his armor only partially melted from the firebolt, rolled to his feet in time to block a web of wire with hailstrike. It sank a solid inch into the ice before stopping. Then it started cutting down into hailstrike again. Hugh ducked back around the doorway long enough to fire another starbolt at the wire mage. But the third mage finally did something. Hugh's starbolt simply detonated in midair. Godric clenched down with his armor on hailstrike, and the handle broke in two. He sent the hammerhead with the wires digging into it, flying towards the swordsman with the iron plates, while the lower part of the handle he sent spearing towards the swordsman with the pliers. Godric tossed the fragments of ice he was still holding, one of them ring-shaped, into the water below the balcony, as the second warlock blocked both attacks with his iron plates.
"Did you feel how he ripped apart your starbolt?"
Godric yelled to Hugh, as he tore chunks of the stone railing loose and started bombarding the two swordsmen. Bits of wire started pelting his armor, sinking into it. They weren't burrowing fast enough for him to need to worry just yet, though. He just needed to buy Hugh enough time to pull off his spell. Godric noticed that the wires seemed to be made of a variety of different metals, not just steel. He somehow tore apart the shielding component of the spell around the starfire itself, Hugh said. Godric narrowed his eyes at that and reached out with his steel magic towards the floating iron plate. The enemy warlock easily wrested control of them away from Godric, but Godric hadn't actually been trying to take control of the plate. It had been a test. As Godric felt the shifts in the stone below the swordsman, he kept up the barrage of stone. Not that he thought they would get through. The wire nets and iron plates were blocking his shots easily. He just needed to keep them on the defensive for a moment longer, though.
"You know, I think I'm rather disappointed,"
the mage with the floating plates called down.
"I'd really hoped the son of Arthur Wallbreaker would be a more impressive foe. But then, what else but disappointment could you expect from something of Wallbreaker's? He should have been one of humanity's great defenders, and instead, he's just a mercenary battle mage, working for monsters like the Crystal Sphinx, who only benefits from our disunity."
Godric did his best to ignore the man's taunts. Some of the wires in his armor were getting perilously deep, but he only needed to wait just a moment longer. With no visible warning at all, the entire roof the Havarthi stood on simply collapsed, the crystal grain of the orange granite having been weakened on a massive scale by Hugh. The Havarthi, unfortunately, didn't collapse with it. Both warlocks hurtled off the collapsing roof and towards the roof of Godric's own building, hauled by wires. Godric immediately activated the spell form to collapse his armor. The mixed ice and stone dropped off him in great chunks, the burrowing wires deep within it. Godric summoned the newly formed hailstrike to his hand from the lake. It thankfully hadn't been crushed by the stone chunks falling into the canal. He dodged inside with Hugh before the Havarthi could recover and immediately started rebuilding his armor out of stone.
"We've got a wire mage and a lodestone mage on our roof," Godric said. "Lodestone mages are a perfect counter to lightning mages too, so I'm betting it's similar with starfire."
"Wire mage?" Hugh asked.
"Well, ductility mage. He's carrying a blacksmith's enchanted wire drawing tools. Reckon he probably can't control non-wire metal, but can turn it into wire easily enough."
"That's bizarre," Hugh said.
"I can feel them both up on the roof still, or at least the iron they're carrying."
Hugh was about to say something, then scowled.
"Look outside and tell me what you see," he told Godric. "I think they've just trapped us in here."
Godric raised an eyebrow at that, but poked his helmeted head out the door. Through his quartz faceplate, he could see spell forms made of wire floating in midair, stretching out of sight in either direction. There's a wire ward around the building, Godric said, pulling his head inside. How'd you feel that?
Hugh shrugged. I'm getting pretty sensitive to wards these days. If you can cover me for a little bit, I can probably break through the ward.
I've got a better idea, Godric said.
Hugh's spellbook gave him a nervous look as he smiled at it.